So I'm going to be talking about the Tao Te Ching this morning. We just finished up the study group just this last Tuesday on the Tao Te Ching, so that's what's been on my mind lately, so that's what I want to talk about. So the Tao Te Ching was written by Lao Tzu in the 6th century. Lao Tzu means old sage. And according to legend, we know nothing about Lao Tzu, actually. If I forget to, you know, speak up, somebody just raise your hand back there and that will remind me. So the legend about Lao Tzu is that he was the keeper of the archives at the imperial court. And when he was 80 years old, he decided to leave the imperial court, and he set out for the western border of China toward what is now Tibet. According to the legend, he did this because he was saddened by, you know, people not following the Tao, not following his teachings. But at the border, the guard asked him to record his teachings before he left, and legend has it that he sat down and in one sitting he wrote the Tao Te Ching. So I'll be giving you a little taste of the Tao Te Ching by two different translators this morning. But I'm really just going to be talking about the title, the Tao Te Ching, the title, which is really means I'll be talking about two things, Tao and De. Tao and De. Jing just refers to the text. So the title, sometimes it's translated as the way and its power. So I'm going to start by talking about the Tao as the way of things. And then after, it's also translated as path. It's often translated as path, the Tao. So the way of things and the path is the way I see it. They're just two aspects of a single dynamic. So I'll start by talking about that and then move on to the next character, Da, Tao Te Ching. So the way of things has been called. I won't be saying too much about it, because it has been called the mystery, the great unknown, unknowable. It's been called the unnamed, darkness, unconditioned, primal energy, the undifferentiated. So it's the fundamental nature of reality. And it's that from which all things arise, and to which all things return. But as soon as you say that from which all things arise and to which all things return, now you're describing a path. So as soon as you try and separate these two aspects of the single dynamic, you find that you can't do it. You can't separate the Tao from its manifestations or the Tao from its functions any more than you could separate the wood in this lectern from the molecules and the atoms that make it up, which are hidden, right? They're completely hidden. They're very mysterious. We also can't separate this piece of wood from the energy that's contained within the molecules and its atoms. So the Tao, the way, refers to reality as an interconnected organic whole. Often in Zen we use the word totality. And nothing exists separately from the Tao. So not only is the Tao the undifferentiated, unnamed, darkness, unconditioned, primal energy, but it is also the differentiated, the named, the conditioned, the manifested. So one of the reasons why literature like the Tao Te Ching, also some literature that we're going to be studying coming up next week called Genjo Koan, the reason why they can be so confusing is that the author doesn't try and separate them. So in one sentence, or maybe even one phrase of one sentence, they're talking about the undifferentiated, and in the very next breath, they're talking about the differentiated. And it's up to you to figure it out. Because that's the way it is in real life. There's a Zen koan that says, "What was your original face before your mother was born?" You guys, some of you guys are familiar with that. What was your mother's face? What did your mother's face look like, or what was your original face before your mother was born? So this koan takes you directly into the mystery, into the unnamed, the unconditioned, the unknown, and the unknowable. And then it places them directly in your immediate everyday life. It's talking about your face, your mother, talking about birth and death. So we can't separate our lives from the fundamental nature of the universe. Not even our everyday life. And also, one of the reasons why literature like the Tao Te Ching can be so confusing is that there are several themes in it. It talks about harmonizing and compassion and virtue. But it doesn't work in a way that it starts with the easy part and takes you, it doesn't try to separate everything out so that you can look at them clearly separately. The very first chapter of the Tao Te Ching is often called the most difficult, because in the very first chapter it contains the entire teaching of the Tao Te Ching. So I'm going to give you a little taste of the Tao Te Ching by reading that first chapter. I'm going to read from Ursula Le Guin's translation. She calls it rendition, because she's not a translator. She's lived with the Tao Te Ching all her life, though, because her father was really into it and used to read it to her when she was young. And so her translation is very poetic, and she has titles to the chapters, which most of them don't. And she titled the first chapter Daoing. She titled it a verb, Daoing. The way you can go isn't the real way. The name you can say isn't the real name. Heaven and earth, being in the unnamed, names the mother of the 10,000 things, which refers to everyday, ordinary life. So the unwanting soul sees what's hidden, and the ever-wanting soul sees only what it wants. Two things, one origin, but different in name, whose identity is mystery. Mystery of all mysteries, the door to the hidden. So, right in the middle of talking about the mystery and the undifferentiated, she has a verse in there. There's a verse in there. She didn't do it. Lao Tzu did it. About desire. The unwanting soul sees what's hidden. The ever-wanting soul sees only what it wants. So they're just throwing in there, that which keeps us from seeing this for ourselves, because we're so distracted by desire, which there again takes us right to the second noble truth, right? So it's hard to, you can't even try to separate these. Just let them be what they are and go with the flow of it. Let's see, I have in here that I should read the third stanza of chapter 2. Let's see what that is. I don't even remember. For being and non-being arise together. Hard and easy complete each other. Long and short shape each other. High and low depend on each other. Note and voice make the music together. Before and after follow each other. So that's pretty cool. Can't separate anything any more than you can separate short from long. So now I'm going to talk about, spend the rest of my time talking about the next character in the title. Da. Or De. Dao De Jing. It's really hard to say it when you separate it too. which to my understanding just refers to our relationship with the Tao. And the most common translation for this character, Da, is virtue. It's also translated sometimes as power, but not the type of power that probably immediately comes to mind, referring to the power to act from, directly from, the source from which all things come and go. But I'm going to be talking about it most of the time. I'm going to be talking about the translation of De as virtue. And there are three kinds of virtue. So I want to just talk about that really briefly before we get started, so that just to orient you to this word virtue. There's cosmic virtue, and that's what I've been talking about so far. Cosmic virtue is the movement of energy from the Tao to the differentiated world. So in other words, cosmic virtue is about the manifestations of the Tao into the 10,000 things. Then there's human virtue, which refers to how we receive this energy and manifest it in our everyday life. And then there's also, of course, moralistic virtue, which I won't be talking about, which I never really talk about. but it is talked about in the Tao Te Ching. It's talked about about when they talk about how we treat each other. But again, how we treat each other, if we're manifesting the energy of the Tao, then we don't have to worry about being nice to each other, because it will just happen spontaneously, which is why I don't really talk about. Moralistic values are so often tied to our culture. So even when the Tao is referring to moralistic virtue, it's not the type of moralistic way of being that we often think about when we relate it to religiosity. That's more about culture. So three of the translations that we used in the study group talked about virtue as, Ursula Le Guin called it primal virtue. Red Pine called it dark virtue. Ursula Le Guin called it the mysterious power. So Ursula Le Guin preferred power over virtue. So that's how she translated it. Often when I'm reading from Ursula Le Guin, I just keep translate it back to virtue, just because that's my personal preference. But another translation that we used Diane English? Was it Diane Linda English? I can't remember the first name, but she called it primal virtue. So Yinling Feng said, Virtue is the manifestation of the way. The way is what virtue contains. Without the way, virtue would have no power. Without virtue, the way would have no appearance. So our guiding teacher here, Tim Burkett, when he's talking about the way and its manifestations, he likes to use the phrase individual and undivided. I kind of like that, individual and undivided. So to practice the teachings of the Tao Te Ching, we have to learn how to manifest both our individual nature and our undivided nature. It's like walking life's path with one foot in the differentiated and one foot in the undifferentiated. Oh, when you're walking, your 2 feet are in harmony, right? We stumble sometimes. When we're not being very mindful, we trip over some obstacle like desire. We see something we want, or we see something we want to get away from. And then suddenly our weight is shifted. It's shifted to the foot that's grounded in the reality of distinctions, of differentiation, of comparing. So we're off balance. We're limping along. And limping is suffering. It doesn't matter what the desire is. Could be a very altruistic desire. But as soon as your weight is shifted and you're limping, whatever the outcome, it will involve suffering. Or maybe it's the other way. Maybe we've shifted our weight more to the foot that's grounded in the undifferentiated, in emptiness. Same thing, right? We're limping along, suffering. So, manifesting the teachings of the Tao Te Ching is about harmonizing the Tao and its manifestations. And that's what virtue, human virtue, is pointing to. So human virtue is about the receiving and manifesting of this cosmic energy that we call the Tao. It's not about what we do. It's about the source from which we do it. And that's how it differs also, I think, from the moralistic virtue. And the experience is one of openness. The experience is one of being completely connected to life's processes. Completely connected to life's processes. So virtue, the type of virtue that's in the talked about in the Tao Te Ching, is about openness. So Andrea Martin gave the talk last week before last, or the last talk that I heard. I didn't hear her last talk. And her second talk, she said, being open creates a space for something different to arise. Being open creates a space for something new to arise. So most people think that being one with the Tao, going with the natural flow of the universe, would be wonderful. Sounds really wonderful, doesn't it? But there's a problem. There's a problem with that we face every time we try to actually put that into practice. And that problem is that the natural flow of the universe has no concern for our agendas. mm. It does not align itself whatsoever to our wants and aversions. The unwanting soul sees what is hidden. The ever-wanting soul sees only what it wants. So here we go, limping along, right? We had our best intentions. Openness is the opposite of pursuing an agenda. When we have a certain agenda in mind, we're entangled in striving, expectations, clinging to this, avoiding that. We're so entangled in this mental activity that there's no space for something new. There's no space for something different to come up. So here's how the Tao Te Ching describes openness. The wise have no mind of their own, finding it in the minds of the ordinary. They are kind to good people, and they are kind to bad people. They trust people of good faith. They trust people of bad faith. Virtue is trust. They mingle their life with the world. They mix their mind up with the world. Trust is openness. So virtue is trust. Trust is openness. When we have trust, we allow things to happen. But that doesn't mean that we don't act. This kind of virtue, type of virtue that is composed of trust and openness, it allows us to guide without interfering. Guide without interfering. That phrase really caught me when I first read it. Guide without interfering. This is chapter 51 from Red Pine. The way begets them, virtue keeps them, matter shapes them, usage completes them. Thus do all creatures respect the way and honor virtue. Their respect for the way and honor of virtue are not conferred, but simply natural, for the way begets and keeps them, raises and trains them, steadies and adjusts them, maintains and protects them, but it doesn't possess what it begets, or depend on what it develops, or control what it raises. This is called dark virtue. That was Red Pine's translation of chapter 51. So we have the capacity to guide without interfering because we are both influenced by the Tao and we influence the Tao. As the Tao moves through us, it is changed. But guiding without interfering requires deep intuitive insight and a keen sense of timing. The commentary about this chapter 51 that I just read, the commentary by Wu Qing says, "In spring, from one root many are begotten. The way becomes virtue. In fall, the many are brought back together. Virtue becomes the way." So the way becomes virtue. When we're open, energies flow freely. They arise, and we actually feel them arising. And if we don't interfere, they harmonize. leaving us with a sense of peacefulness. So what I just described is what we experience on the cushion in Zen meditation. When we're open, energies flow freely. They arise. We know a lot of stuff arises when we're sitting on the cushion. And if we don't interfere, they harmonize, leaving us with a sense of peacefulness. Virtue becomes the way. And this peacefulness doesn't come from the shallows. It's not Pollyanna, and it's not some contrived exercise in relaxation. It's a peacefulness that will sustain us wherever we are. Sometimes it takes a long time for these energies to harmonize. Sometimes we have to feel the whatever is arising, the anger, the sadness, the grief, whatever it is. Sometimes it takes a long time for that to harmonize. Sometimes we have to feel it pretty deeply. That's why we practice. It's okay. That's why we practice. Through practice, we learn to trust our capacity to guide without interfering, to harmonize energies rather than control or direct or shut down or avoid. But the wise have no mind of their own, finding it in the minds of ordinary. I think that's supposed to be ordinary people, but I think I left that out. They are kind to good people and they are kind to bad people. They trust people of good faith. They trust people of bad faith. So it's very likely when you hear that, they trust people of good faith and they trust people of bad faith. What our mind starts coming up with is all sorts of objections, right? Because the mind gets caught up in what we do. How can we get along in the world if we trust people we shouldn't trust? That would be foolish. We'd be taken advantage of all the time. But the type of trust that the character De is referring to, the type of trust that is a component of virtue, is a type of knowing. A type of knowing. So even when dealing with untrustworthy people, our actions come from a place of trust. We don't trust that they're going to be going against their conditioning, right? Because we know how strong conditioning is. We've sat with our own. In spring, from one root many are begotten. The way becomes virtue. In fall, the many are brought back together. Virtue becomes the way. This says that we know when to exert our energy outward, sometimes referred to as masculine energy, and we know when to focus our energy inward, back toward the source, which is sometimes referred to as feminine energy. So I said that, I mentioned earlier that the character De is sometimes translated as power, and that Ursula Quinn actually prefers that translation. But that's referring to our inherent power, our inner power, that comes from the nature of the universe, from interbeing. Thich Nhat Hanh likes to use the word interbeing. So we know this kind of power, we manifest this kind of power because we are not separate. We are not separate from it. So virtue involves both discernment, which I like to think of as intuitive insight, and the power to act in the world. And discernment, intuitive insight, involves deep listening. In Zazen, we listen. We don't engage in our thoughts because thinking is not listening. It's not that thinking is bad, it's that thinking is not listening. It's that we think all the time. The Tao doesn't exclude thinking. But it becomes a problem when we think all the time and rather than listen. This deep listening that I'm referring to. So how do we quiet the mind? We do a lot of struggling with that, don't we? Here in these rooms. So how do we quiet the mind? Here again, Tao Te Ching. This is the secret of our path. If we try to get rid of something, it will naturally remain. If we try to weaken a habit, it will naturally remain strong. If we try to push away our thoughts, they will naturally return. If we try to get rid of our pain, we will suffer all the more. This is the secret of our path. Gentleness and flexibility bring the results that force and rigidity fail to achieve. Our true benefit lies not in our words or arguments, but in the depth of our practice. So this is about overcoming our conditioning, which we talk about a lot here. Because our conditioning is the obstacle. It's the obstacle from manifesting the natural flow of the universe, the Tao. Studying other people brings us knowledge. Studying our own mind brings us freedom. Overcoming other people requires force. Overcoming our conditioning requires true power. Overcoming our conditioning requires virtue, with a capital V. Some translators actually distinguish the type of virtue that De is referring to by capitalizing the V. Red Pine does that. But we do try to get rid of, don't we? We do try to weaken our habits. We do try to push them away. And that's okay, that's where we start because that's where we are. So what do we do? What does this teaching about virtue tell us to do? It tells us to stay open. It tells us that openness is trust. So when you're struggling, trust your struggle. Just trust your struggle. And as soon as you stop struggling against your struggle and start just looking at what's happening, the struggle is gone. You're just looking at what's happening. Your thoughts are coming one right after another. Look at the thoughts. Just look at them. And suddenly, You'll find yourself doing what just a few moments ago you couldn't do. Because just a few moments ago, you were entangled in the struggle, and now you're experiencing trust. You're just looking at the thoughts, not trying to stop them, you're just looking at them. And when trust is present, you're able to see clearly. And when seeing a thought all the way through, that's the power of virtue at work. When we're able to see our thoughts all the way through to the conditioning from which they arise, that's the power of virtue at work. And when you feel it in this way, when you experience it in this way, it doesn't really feel mysterious anymore. It feels like intimacy. It feels intimate. When a strong emotion arises and we're able to stay open to it, this is the work of virtue. When you actually experience the permeability of a strong emotion, when you experience your awareness flowing into it, creating space within it, harmonizing, instead of struggling to get rid of it, you know that you've experienced this mysterious power. And again, it doesn't feel mysterious anymore. Just feels intimate. Acting without interfering, without controlling, without striving. So as long as we try to control things, we'll never experience this kind of intimacy. Because whatever we try to control, we separate ourselves from, right? So how do we learn to let go of the need to control? How do we do that? Chapter 63, study the hard while it's easy. Do big things while they're small. The hardest jobs in the world start out easy. The great affairs of the world start small. So the wise soul, by never dealing with great things, gets great things done. Freeing ourselves from our fear-based reactive responses and allowing the Tao to flow freely through us is a big thing. It's a great thing. But we start doing big things when they are small. Start by practicing on the cushion in a place like this, where we're never triggered by external events when we're sitting on the cushion, because nothing's happening. When thoughts and emotions come up, they come up naturally, untriggered. And that's when it's easy. And that's why we're here. That's why we sustain this place. That's why we keep it up. That's why we come here in the mornings. We come here in the evenings. We sit on the cushion. That's why we do retreats. One-day retreats, two-day retreats, seven-day retreats. Study the hard while it's easy. Do big things while they're small. So I think I'm going to end with that while we still have some time for some conversation, some questions. Hi.
Hi. You read in the middle from the text about where it refers to the practice, something in your text on your sheet. And I'm wondering, within the framework of Taoism, what do they mean by practice?
Exactly what I've been talking about, virtue. Virtue. Okay. Yes, and you can't really separate it. You can't really separate human virtue from cosmic virtue. Expressing the allowing the Tao to flow freely through us, and I talked about how we do that. That is all about the practice.
Okay. For me, it's like, of course, from like the meditation cushion Zen practice. You know what I'm saying? So, yeah. So I kind of, my brain wasn't quite sure
so
what
we practice on the cushion, mm-hmm. if we're not able to take that out into the real world, the ordinary world, and see ourselves responding differently because of what mm-hmm. we practiced on the cushion, then what good is it? Thank you.
Thanks for the talk, Wanda. You were talking about struggling and trusting your struggle, and this is intimacy. One word that comes into my mind is also vulnerability.
Yeah.
When you're open. Mm-hmm. And for me, in my life, that also then fear arises after mm-hmm. that because you feel, you're vulnerable. And so, how do you, balance that, or how do you deal with that fear that can arise when you make yourself that vulnerable?
That's where the trust arises.
Yeah.
That's where it comes in. Yes, and you can't separate it. It's just like the the manifestations of the Tao create its appearance. Without the manifestation, it would remain hidden. Without your fear, your trust would have no appearance. Does this make sense? So when the fear arises, that gives you the opportunity to cultivate trust. And when it arises on a cushion, it's pretty, it's pretty easy, relatively easy. When fear arises out in the ordinary world, it's really hard not to go into our conditioned reactivity, but we learn how to do it on the cushion. We learn how to see the fear arising, and we learn how to just open up to it, let it move through us. And after we've experienced that, often enough on the cushion, then it starts to become a natural way of responding to this chaotic energy that we call fear. Our anger, our grief, our whatever. I mean, we handle all the energies of our body in exactly the same way, by just opening up. By just opening up and letting them flow through. And then responding in some way. And we practice that over and over and over on the cushion until it really does start to become natural. Almost like imprinted, I read earlier, openness is trust. Trust is openness, and you really will start to experience that in an intimate way. And it's no longer just words anymore. I started a new job, and I got fearful a lot when my supervisor was standing over me. I started a new job about a year ago, giving me this long list of what he wanted me to do on the computer. And I was way up here thinking, how the hell am I going to do that? And now he's all the way down here. And I would feel the fear arising that I wasn't going to be able to do that. But I could feel it way down here. It was natural for me to go down there and open up to it, just let it kind of flow through. It didn't freeze up my mind. So I actually did hear what he was saying. And I knew that once he walked away, I'd figure it out. I trusted that, and it really did work out that way. I still have the job. So it really does start to affect your ordinary life.
Thank you.
Okay, so I don't really know what really my question is, but so it has something to do with other lives, and so the Tibetans are really piled into you know, it's axiomatic that reincarnation is, the whole practice is based on, and the whole hierarchy is based on reincarnation, but there's other lives. And what, and so then you can go way back into the distant, the mists of the prehistory to find this other life. And and so there's an uncanny sense of, I mean, when you talk about fear, there's like, you know, that what, you know, I shouldn't be here, so I'm afraid of the situation. Like, I want to leave the dark forest. And then this thing shouldn't be here. You know, that's an intruder. And so there's this sense of, you know, the, you know, your hair on end and your throat, your mm-hmm. mouth caught, your voice caught in your throat, and there's this. So what about, I guess what I'm saying is, where is the Tao and the way on this? I mean, because if we're all interbeing, we all go back into the mists of prehistory. So where is the Tao and the way on this other life, as in diachronically other, as in very prior?
So I think you're asking me, what is the Tao's view of past lives, right?
Yeah, I would include reincarnation, past lives as other lives. Because I think you can get away with...
Okay. I'll say what I can say to this.
But only as other lives.
I'm going to follow Buddha's guide on when it comes to past lives and reincarnation. He didn't talk about it. So I don't... It's not that I don't believe in it. I don't believe it nor disbelieve it. I really appreciate the mystery of it all. But I can speak on the... what I'll say about other lives, to me, I think about, you know, what's out there. There's a lot of fear out there in this energy that's around us all the time. There's a lot of anger. And so it's manifested in our own life for two reasons. One, conditioning. Two, because it's out there. There's so much suffering in the world, and we are not separate from it. You know, part of the nationalistic view is that we can isolate ourselves and it doesn't matter what's going on out there in other countries, because we can be over here and we can be happy. All we have to do is keep a strong economy. This will never be true, because as long as there's suffering out there, there will be suffering everywhere. There's no border. You know, and when you walk into a room where there's a lot of an angry discussion, an angry debate, where tempers are really high, you feel it when you walk in. And it's very difficult. If you stay there, before you know it, you're going to be just as angry, just as loud. You're going to be, all those biological, physiological descriptions you had, the throat, the voice, you know. That's just our physiological response to the emotions that's coming up in our body. I think the fear comes first, and then we react to them. We react in the way that we've been conditioned to react. Everything kind of shuts down so we can run. That's how we survived way back when in past lives. But when the fear or the anger, you can feel it as it starts to arise and just open up to it, then you really don't experience all of those physiological reactions. And I know this in my own life, because I used to have panic attacks. I could never speak in front of people, even a small crowd. I mean, my voice would get really, I called it tinny. Tinny. I would shake. I couldn't do it. I just couldn't do it. These were physiological reactions to my fear. But you sit on the cushion and you just allow this to come up over and over and over. You learn how to cultivate the capacity to just stay open over and over and over. This is virtue. This is virtue as it is talked about in the character Devil. Something over here?
in essence, the Tao is ever-changing.
Yes.
So if our trust,
which is why we can influence it.
Right, exactly. If our trust in our openness is allowing for our trust in the ever-changing, these things will just manifest themselves, and that's where the trust comes in. That's the virtue.
Yes, yes. And that is also how we influence the Tao. I think that's kind of behind the whole idea of the tipping point, you know. And things just change because we've changed. There's more peacefulness in the air.
Basic Zazen question, because I hear you keep referring to just sitting with, right, things that arise.
Mm-hmm.
What if things don't arise?
Then maybe you have a very, very peaceful heart.
I feel sometimes as if I want to, like, you know, immerse myself in fire or something while I'm sitting, because I've been sitting for some time and I keep sitting and I keep returning to my cushion, and I don't know, you know, I don't feel as things arise like I hear mm-hmm. some people saying things arise.
Mm-hmm.
And so, any suggestions?
So people often start by following their breath. So they'll let go of the thoughts or not get engaged in the thoughts. You're not stopping the thoughts, you're just watching the thoughts. And then you, when you, and keep returning to your breath when you when you notice that your mind has wandered off. I would suggest that you just return into your body, the deepest part of your body, your hara. Start returning there and just being there and being there and being there. I have certain power places in my body that I've discovered since I've started doing meditation. And one of them is the hara, another one is deep down here behind my chest. And when I sit with my awareness there, whatever my intent is starts to manifest. So I would suggest that you try that.
Thank you.
Your mind has to be much, it's kind of advanced practice, because it's much easier to come back to our breath and anchor our awareness in our breath, because it's a physical thing. It's not as subtle. These are very, very subtle places. Mm-hmm. And when you touch them, you feel it. But it's very subtle. The mind has to be really still. So keep start holding that intent to find these places, the nooks and crannies, where this energy that you feel maybe you're obstructed in some way, but you can't figure out what it is. Mm-hmm. Hold that intent. Allow your awareness to move into the subtle places of your body. Let go of the breath. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Wanda?
Yeah.
When Carrie asked this question, the first thing that came to mind was a suggestion from you during mindfulness class, which is just simply no expectation before you start the meditation. Because for me that was incredibly
yes.
helpful, because I had ideas in my mind sitting that something would happen, or I would relax, or you know, mm-hmm. something that I would have in mind that I would achieve during the meditation before I started. And that was just one of the most helpful things that you said during that whole 6-week class, and you were only the teacher one day.
Well, thank you.
But yeah, no
expectations. No expectations is of course, is very, very important. Because whatever we expect is going to be different from that. Always is, because it's new, it's different. And that what I was talking about is that openness. You have to be very open. You're creating space for something new to come up,
going,
as Andrea said. Pardon? Go
going
ahead.
Into places in your body as a, it, would that be akin to Vipassana meditation?
You know, I know a little bit about Vipassana, but not enough to say anything about it from this seat, so I'd rather not.
Real quickly, recently learned, and I shared this with Ben a couple weeks ago, a new Buddhist joke that I don't know how clear this will be, but a librarian is saying to a customer, Vipassana meditation, that's over in the no self help section.
I think I've gone over my time. And get to the, I'll turn it over to the Doan now. Thank you, everybody.
Hello, everyone. I have a few announcements, and I will start by passing out to Donna Bull. Donna, for generosity, and we thank you for your donations. And Ted, do you want to talk a little bit about the hospital?
Yeah,